Okay, beginning with question one. You ask the difference between distance education, homeschooling, and e-learning. Distance education is education that takes place at a distance. I know that seems sort of obvious, but the idea is that the teacher and the student are in different locations. The actual medium in which education happens can vary. It might be by radio, it might be by print media, it might be by telephone, that's how I began teaching, or it might be online. Homeschooling, by contrast, is learning that takes place, as the name implies, in the home. Now, by home, we mean really any place that is more under the control of the parent than, say, an educational institution. Homeschooling can and often does take place outside the home in places like libraries, museums, etc. Sometimes with and sometimes without the supervision, the direct supervision of the parent. Homeschooling also sometimes can happen in a friend or neighbor's home if you have more than one parent actually sharing the duties of homeschooling, of a homeschooling teacher. There's no particular medium for homeschooling, but homeschooling is often supported with distance education resources, that is, resources that are obtained by telephone, by mail, or more usually now, by internet. The third classification is e-learning, and this is learning that is supported through the use of digital media. The most obvious instance of e-learning is online learning, and that happens when the internet is used to distribute digital media. But in the early days of e-learning as well, it was very common to have, for example, CD-ROMs or other electronic media devices that would be used to transport content. And so e-learning would include both recorded media as well as media distributed through the internet. My own specialization is none of these. It is, in fact, online learning, which is learning that is supported through the use of the internet. This obviously includes distance learning, though I no longer work on telephone or radio-supported learning. This can include homeschooling to the extent that online learning can support homeschooling. And of course it can and does include e-learning because the media in online learning are all necessarily digital media. What's distinct about online learning and that makes it different from distance learning and e-learning is that many of the interactions are synchronous. We're not working simply with learning content, but rather an essential part of online learning is the dialogue and interaction that takes place. And so online learning often involves not simply the creation of digital resources, but also, and probably more importantly, the creation of a learning environment where these interactions can take place. Moving to the second question, distance education is based on the principle of inclusion and democratization of education, you suggest in the question, and yet space has been open in which large education groups seek to profit from this model, not always offering quality courses. And that's true, and I'm not going to name any names, though I could. I remember way back in the early days of distance education, this was already a problem. And there was something called Bear's Guide. It was a listing of basically disreputable distance education providers. And it was needed at the time. And if it existed today, it would still be needed. It was sort of the educational equivalent of Beale's List. And that's one of the problems with creating this sort of list. It's not easy to distinguish between quality and non-quality online learning. Traditionally, for in-class learning, we've depended on accreditation agencies. For example, in the U.S. they have these regional boards, and in Canada as well there's a process, and in fact in every country in the world there's a process that recognizes whether a provider is a qualified learning provider. However, this is a bit too narrow, because certainly there can be credible education providers that are not accredited certification agencies. For example, there might be Microsoft certification, Novell certification, etc., which provide good quality education but aren't regionally accredited. And they're not formal institutes of higher learning. And in fact, we see that most online learning comes not from formal institutes of higher learning, but rather through a very informal process. And there are dozens, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of people who provide learning online through media such as YouTube, through media such as blog pages, through media such as podcasts and the like. Now, for the most part, it's benign. For the most part, it's not a problem in the sense that people can pick and choose the learning resource or learning provider that's good for them. But when these providers adopt a commercial model and begin to charge large amounts of money, or even medium amounts of money, then this becomes contentious. Probably the example that most people think of in recent years has been the commercial MOOCs. And I'm thinking specifically of companies like Udemy and other MOOC companies that have adopted a commercial model. I pick on Udemy particularly because it is based on self-guided learning rather than actual classes online, which might include a cohort and real-time support from an instructor. And my experience with those classes is, they're put up online and then abandoned, and people come along later and pay for them, and the quality is, shall we say, mixed. I think that we're in a bit of a chaotic state now. The traditional accredited education providers are offering online learning and are offering it during the pandemic, but they're not reducing their tuition and they're not really providing a discount. And a lot of students have been complaining about that. And I think they have a good reason to complain. And as well, I think that the tuitions that they charge are out of line with the value that they provide. I recently cited a case from, Carnegie Mellon, that was offering a course on how to build an online learning course. And it's nothing you couldn't get from reading my newsletter and reading the resources that I link to, but they're charging $2,700 for it. $2,700. More than $5,000 if you want CMU credit for the course. And I think that's outrageous. And I think that as we move more and more online, these prices will adjust necessarily, because I think that at a certain point people are going to stop paying them, especially for online learning. And when that happens, and that's happening now, there's a crisis in the university system. It's a crisis that I've been predicting for a long time, and it's a crisis of sustainability. It's in some cases an existential crisis. And you know, my thinking is that this is something that should have been addressed a long time ago by the universities, that they should have been thinking about affordability and access. But you know, for the most part, the university education and the university diploma has always been a premium product. It has been a signifier of wealth, and people have been willing to pay premium prices for it. And I think that probably is the market that is most challenged. I'm not sure what else I can say about that, but we'll leave it there for now. Question three. Learning online today means taking a course from a learning management system, is something I said. And the question is, in my opinion, are we still far from being able to explore the full potential, in pedagogical terms, of distance education? Why? If I had to peg it, I would say we were about halfway to meeting that potential. Certainly, if we're just taking a course out of a learning management system, and if it's a traditional course like so many that I've seen, where you just page through the material and maybe take a test and maybe, if you're lucky, engage in some dialogue and perhaps an interaction with a real person who's teaching the course, then we're far away from reaching the pedagogical potential. But I think a lot of innovations in recent years have begun to expand on that, particularly in the areas of online work, collaborative work, synchronous communication, interactive elements in a course, an emphasis on constructivist and constructionist models. And these are things that have helped the learning be something more than just exposure to content that you're expected to remember. These have been forms of learning that involve creativity, expression, and sharing, and as a result, create not simply new knowledge and skills, but a lot of the intangibles of learning, like being able to connect with people in the same discipline, to acquire that vocabulary, that way of thinking, that shared understanding of what counts as a problem, what counts as evidence, even just the way of looking at the world. And, you know, you need these immersive environments, whether they're an audio conference, a video conference, or a simulation. You need these immersive environments to actually begin to think like and actually be like a professional in such and such a discipline, and to be eventually recognized as such by other professionals in that discipline. So this is coming. This is something that we worked on with our massive open online courses. This is something that we worked on with our personal learning environment projects. And this is something that I see a lot of people, both in traditional accredited institutions, as well as corporate learning, as well as informal online learning, a lot of people are working on this. Question 4. According to the UN, more than 156 million students are out of school in Latin America due to COVID. And even before the pandemic, many countries, especially the poorest, face the challenge of providing quality digital technologies and internet for their population. And there are some stats there. How do you think about this digital divide problem? And yeah, it's a problem. And it's not just the digital divide. I mean, if we look worldwide, water and sanitation pose a problem. Electrification poses a problem. Access to information generally poses a problem. Access to employment poses a problem. And, of course, access to the internet and digital technologies poses a problem. And the distribution of these are unequal around the world. That's a fact. That's easily demonstrable. And we can say, well, sure, it's been getting better over the years. And in some ways it has, and in some ways it hasn't. I mean, to look at it cynically, 30 years ago, shall we say, there was no digital divide because there was no digital to begin with. So, we can say, well, geez, in the last 30 years, the digital divide has greatly expanded. And it's true. But it's just one phenomenon out of these many phenomena. And it comes down to a willingness to accept that this is a priority. The World Economic Order, whatever, has not seen this as a priority over the last century, over the last millennium. For the most part, the primary occupation of the wealthier countries has to become more wealthy. And that's true even to this day. And that's a perspective that has a lot of sympathy in wealthy countries. And it's not something that can be changed simply by pointing out that the current order is unjust, and simply by pointing out that, 156 million students are out of school. I wish it could be changed that simply. So I think that longer term, we need to be thinking about how we restructure the world economic order, or maybe I'll call it the world social order, perhaps to shift the priorities a bit, to one that views social, political, and economic equity around the world as a priority. And that's not going to happen simply by the creation of a set of rules and principles. That's only going to happen through an adjustment of the attitudes of the larger bulk of the population, and especially the bulk of the population that currently benefits from the disadvantages created in other nations. And that's going to be a hard sell. And in fact, it's not something that can be sold. It's something that actually has to be created as a fundamental principle of what it means to be in a society. It has to be one of the core values that a child in any of these countries develops as a part of their education. And that means that there's not going to be a short-term solution to this. That doesn't mean, oh no, we're helpless, obviously. And it does mean that those people who have already adopted that sort of perspective, a perspective based on social justice and equity, can begin work on that. And I think that really we address the digital divide only by creating an environment for technological and social development that incorporates equity as its fundamental principle and definition of progress. So we don't measure how far we've gone by simple averages. We don't measure how far we've gone by how much a single individual can earn or create or whatever. But we measure it by what all of us, each of us, including the least of us, is able to do. A measure of their capacity to enjoy the benefits of society, where one of those benefits is access to digital technology. So it goes back to governments and organizations, mine here in Canada and yours in Brazil and elsewhere, identifying social equity and social justice as priorities and making these key policy priorities. I wish I had a simpler, more direct answer, but I don't. And in the meantime, what I will keep doing is trying to create an educational system, including educational technology, that is based on and incorporates and has as an outcome ongoing support for social justice and equity. Question 5. Canada has a tradition in distance education. Can you mention one or more concrete examples of how Canada in the last decades has been able to expand this model of distance learning? This model of distance learning. Not this marvel of distance learning. I'm experimenting, just so you know, with software called Otter AI, and it is doing a terrific job, I must say, although it has its moments. And you know, the development of AI is probably one of those key things. You know, a lot of the major developments in artificial intelligence and related technologies originated in Canada. You know, everything from elements of the semantic web, like XML, to the pioneering work done by people like Donald Hebb, psychologist, and Jeffrey Hinton in Neural Networks. These are things that have had and having an enormous impact on online learning. And we don't feel it quite yet, although here I am speaking my answers and having them typed out automatically by an artificial intelligence. And I think that's pretty incredible. You know, we in Canada don't have a national system. So a lot of our initiatives have been local or have been provincial. Education is a provincial responsibility in Canada. And our educational systems are organized differently in each province. We have things like BC Campus in British Columbia and eCampus Ontario in Ontario. And these are the latest in a series of provincial initiatives over the years that have supported and expanded online and distance learning. I'm thinking of the Open Learning Academy, OLA, in British Columbia many years ago. There's TELUC in Quebec, Tele University in Quebec. Contact North, which I've worked on and off with over the years. Athabasca University, which is Canada's open university. So these organizational initiatives have all played a role in promoting open access to learning, to developing learning technology, to pioneering new ways of creating and distributing online resources, to thinking about pedagogical changes. You know, the work by Garrison, Anderson, and I'm trying to remember the third. Oh, Walter Archer. You know, this was supported by, places like Contact North and Athabasca University and other places. I wish Otter AI knew Athabasca. It doesn't. It comes out differently each time. Athabasca. Athabasca. I'm trying to train it. Nope. Anyhow. In terms of pedagogy and learning theory, Canada was home to many constructivist initiatives and progressive learning. I, in fact, was one of the beneficiaries of that in the 1970s. I experienced things like elective classrooms, open concept learning, small classes, and many other things that were being tried for the first time. And I think some of them worked. I'd like to think some of them worked. In my own work, I've touched on a number of areas that people across Canada have been working on in the way of expanding distance education, beginning with CompuGraphics in the 1990s with Athabasca, continuing through learning management systems, which we developed in Manitoba, in the late 1990s, to online learning portals, which I worked on with the University of Alberta in the 2000s. And then more recently, as most people know, the work that was done to create the massive open online course which to my mind had as a permanent impact the normalization of the idea of free and open online learning courses and content. And of course, my colleague George Siemens and I worked on the philosophy of connectivism. And this is something that's based in the work of people like Hinton and many others. Also people like Paul and Patricia Churchland, who were based in Manitoba. And as well, there are many influences. So anyhow. And many of the first learning management systems were developed in Canada originally. WebCT, for example. Desire to Learn, which is a major learning management system today, is developed in Canada. So I think that if I had to summarize, the contribution Canada has made over the years has been to make learning more student-centered, more open, more affordable and more accessible, and more democratic in the sense that learning is governed by learners themselves, by the community in which they live, and by the community of communities across the country. And I think all of these have together had as an outcome a greater capability on the part of people who have benefited from this kind of learning to be more self-directed, more resilient, more capable, and more knowledgeable. And, you know, I look at the reaction of Canadians and of even our governments during this pandemic, and I think that pretty much our system of learning has proven itself very effective, where the population as a whole is, working with and listening to the scientific community, making decisions mostly reasonably and responsibly, and has an understanding that, during a case like this, the primary responsibility of government and of society is to make sure that all people are protected and all people are made as secure as possible. And that, I think, is a good outcome. I don't know if that answered the question, but that's what I got. Okay, question 6. Distance education has become a very profitable business in recent years. Large educational groups profit millions of dollars by offering online courses. In Brazil, most distance education courses are offered by private institutions and are aimed at teacher training. Yeah. However, there is little regulation of this market, at least in Brazil. So how to control and regulate this market in order to guarantee the quality of the courses? So I think that, there are two options here. One option is to maintain the private system and attempt to regulate it. The other is to ensure that quality resources and quality learning opportunities are made available as a public service. I favor the second option. I favor the option where the government, which after all works on behalf of the people, works with the best people in the field, or, you know, I shouldn't say the best, works with capable people in the field, because a lot of people are needed, to create learning opportunities that are high quality and support, you know, learning, social, economic, and other objectives, and have as a goal not the creation of revenue for a company, but the creation of a society for everyone. Now, a lot of people say that government is not capable of doing this. Certainly, there are cases where government has failed. But in general, we find that when government produces or manages an educational system, the outcomes are much better and much more equitable than when it is managed by a private institution. And there are many reasons for this. Private institutions cut corners. Private institutions choose to serve the population that produces the most revenue. So, you know, the rich people. Private institutions work in consortia in order to increase the price. And private institutions, if they are working in education specifically, often have other agendas and not, you know, the betterment of the individual and the improvement of the entire society. And that's why they need to be regulated, right? We know that if we did not regulate the private sector in education, that we would have nothing but problems. We see in other industries where if regulation is not sufficient, that the quality and indeed even the safety of the product decreases. And that's something we can't actually afford to have in education. You know, we in our food industry, which is private almost completely, there has to be a comprehensive system of regulation in order to ensure that the population is not poisoned by the food supply. During the coronavirus crisis, we've had issues with retirement homes that are privately run and where safety was disregarded, and where dozens of people died as a result. So what people forget when they're thinking about, you know, private industry being more efficient or more effective, is that there is a substantial cost and a substantial infrastructure required to create this regulatory oversight. And there is a constant battle to ensure that this regulatory oversight remains in place, because there's always the insistence on the part of the private companies that this regulatory oversight is just bureaucracy and red tape and really should be minimized as much as possible. And, you know, I want to minimize red tape too. But, you know, like I said earlier, it comes back to priorities. What are the priorities? And if the priority is social equity and, you know, individual resilience and safety and security for children and students, then a regulatory environment is probably not going to be sufficient. So that's one thing. I have a preference toward trying to provide these services through public provision, where the providers are accountable through the electoral system and where the provision of quality is maintained throughout. The other thing is to help individuals. Oh, gotta stop. Okay, so I just had that brief interruption. The free version of otter.ai is limited to 40 minutes. I've been speaking for 40 minutes. Okay. So I can see one potential weakness of such a system. I can end up speaking for 40 minutes. Okay. So anyhow, the second thing is we need to help students be resilient. I know that's the word of the day. To make sure that they're not able to be ripped off by course providers. So the government content gives them an option to avoid that. You know, the government provision of educational resources, creates an alternative to the providers, to the private providers, forces the prices down, forces the qualities up, or the quality up. But at the same time, so long as there are private providers, and there probably always will be, we need to enable individuals to be able to navigate this marketplace. And it's a lot like being able to navigate, say, the news marketplace or the advertising marketplace, where people are trying to sell you various other goods. And you need skills like critical thinking, basic reasoning, mathematics helps, the fundamentals of statistics. I once wrote an article, Things You Really Need to Learn, which covered some of these basics. You know, everything from learning how to predict consequences to learning how to value yourself. And all of these things are good things to learn just in and of themselves. But these sorts of things are also needed in order to give yourself a fighting chance against, you know, people who want to rip you off. A lot of them are just common sense. But, you know, common sense has to, at some point, be something that we teach people, because people aren't just born with it. Okay, last but not least, to what extent is technology the solution to education problems? And, well, let's finish on a short and easy question, shall we? It's hard to say that technology in and of itself is the solution to anything, right? Technology without a use and without a user is just inert. It may as well be a stone. In fact, stone was a technology at one point. Technology by itself isn't the solution to anything. On the other hand, we have in philosophy and in science generally, this concept of necessary and sufficient conditions. And when I say when I say that technologically by itself isn't the solution to anything, what I'm saying is that technology by itself is not a sufficient condition for education problems, for a solution. And there's another way of looking at it, right? And that is to ask, is technology a necessary condition for the solution to educational problems. And I'm going to argue that it is. And I'm going to argue that it is on economic grounds. And this is an argument that goes back many years. It's not original to me by any means. I first heard it from the former chancellor of the Open University, whose name escapes me at the moment. See if I remember it in a few seconds. Sir John Daniel. It's tricky doing these things live. You have to have everything at the top of your head. And his argument basically was, there is not enough money in the world to provide traditional education from kindergarten through to the end of university to everybody, or even close to everybody. Think about how many millions of universities would be needed. Well, maybe hundreds of thousands of universities, I'm not sure, to serve a population of 7 or 8 billion people. You know, people don't run the numbers. We said above that, you know, the digital divide is a question of priorities. Another aspect to this question of priorities is what constitutes an education? What constitutes quality education? What does the solution to problems of education look like? And a lot of people say, well, the only possible, the only proper solution to issues involving education is one where you have a human teacher for children. A human teacher for, say, each class of, oh, I don't know, 30 is too many, maybe 20 students. And so, okay, that means that one out of every 20 people need to be teachers, maybe, because learning is lifelong now. What does it take to produce that many teachers? One out of 20 is 5%. What's 5% of 7 billion people? What are the salaries of 5% of 7 billion people? You know, you're suddenly looking at astronomical numbers. And if you could provide an education, bracket, when we haven't defined that, just what we mean by that yet, close bracket. If you could provide an education using technology that requires a fraction of the number of people to provide it, then you are much further advanced in providing an education for all. You know, I often have observed that the arguments in favor of quote-unquote quality education are at the same time arguments against accessible education, because the higher quality you make it, the more expensive you make it, the less accessible it is. So we have to be looking to technology not simply to replace people, because that's not the best way of looking at it, but as a way of making each individual able to provide more learning for more people at a higher quality. And yeah, that's not a simple thing to do, and nobody thinks it will be done overnight. But to say that something like that would be impossible, I think, is wrong. And to say that technology would play no role in providing a quality education for every one of the 7 billion people or more on the planet would be ludicrous. I mean, you can't contemplate providing all the learning that all the people need on Earth without technology. So I see this as a pretty simple question to answer. You know, it's like asking, to what extent is technology the solution to the problem of hunger? Well, you actually can't feed people, all people, without technology. It's a necessary condition to address the problem of hunger. And then we can debate about, you know, what kind of technology works. You know, in the case of food production, was the Green Revolution that technology innovation that we needed? Were hybrid seeds the innovation that we needed? Golden rice, for example. Is advanced fertilization what we needed? Is advanced irrigation what we needed? Reclamation of desert or otherwise unproductive land? New crops, new crop genetics like canola. You can't really measure, well, I suppose you could, but it's not a productive enterprise to measure how important one or another of these was, or how, you know, to what extent any one of these or even all of these together alleviated hunger. But we know that they were necessary to do so to the extent that we've done so. And the same will be in the case of online learning. A simple example, learning resource production today is a multi-billion dollar industry. Here I'm thinking of things like textbooks, course packages, recorded lectures, online courses, all of that. Across primary, secondary, university, and corporate learning. Multi-billion dollar industry. We are very close at this point to having artificial intelligence technology that can produce these resources automatically on an as-needed basis. I mean, right now, this AI here is typing out my stuff for me so I don't have to do it. I think that's so wonderful. And eventually it can just take what I know, you know, maybe summarize all of the verbal input, audio input that I've given it, and maybe pictures that I've drawn, whatever I've written over the years, and just automatically create little resource packages. The thought of Stephen Downs or whatever. And all of a sudden, we've created a mechanism to automatically save billions of dollars in the provision of education for everyone. It would be crazy not to use technology to do that. There would be a great deal of resistance to it, not the least from the people and the companies that are making billions of dollars off of a worldwide demand for education. And so it comes down to priorities again, right? What's more important, making sure everybody has an education or making sure that these companies survive? What's more important, that we support high-level elite universities, or that we apply all of the technology that we have to ensure that everybody in the world is able to read, to write, to reason, both logically and mathematically, etc. To me, this choice is pretty obvious. To me, using technology in order to make education more accessible and higher quality for people is a no-brainer. And that you use it where you can. People say a lot, well, you can't have technology driving the pedagogy. Yeah, to an extent that's true. Mm-hmm. We as humans are the ones who would determine what the outcome is, what the objective is, what the goal is, what we're trying to do with education. But once we've made those decisions, does it matter whether humans or technology drive the pedagogy? Are humans automatically going to have the best right answer? You know, we already know that in human versus AI games, the AI often wins. In areas of creativity, as in artificial intelligence, generated music or text or poems or whatever, right now the AI creations aren't very good, but they're getting better, and we can easily imagine one that's better than one a human created. So at a certain point, an AI pedagogy might be better than one a human can create. If you want to learn something, just let the AI take over. It knows who you are, it knows what you've done, it knows what you're capable of, and it can pick from the most effective and most reasonably priced resources and run you through your paces, and you're able to learn. That's a really good objective to work for. We need what they call the human in the loop to make sure that this is safe, effective, and ethical. But at the same time, if we take seriously the question of education for every one of 7 or 8 billion people, then we have to be looking at technology and a fairly extensive application of technology, just as we have applied it in every other discipline in which we work. Okay, that's my answers to the questions. It's about an hour, so it makes a pretty good podcast too, maybe. I don't know. So I'll send you this, and I'll also post it on my website, because that's what I do. And let's see what you make out of it. Nice talking to you. Oops. Should have paused it.